everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. This is a show empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. And it's great having you with me today, especially with the conversation we're going to be having today. It's a really important conversation, and I'm just glad you're here with me. This show is all about empowering you with the knowledge, with the information, as much as we can stay on the leading edge of the research to really help you understand what's going on, navigate through the world so you can have the greatest health and healing possible in your life. If you are listening for the very first time, I want to welcome you and thank you for joining me today. I encourage you to go to my website, drcherylselman.com. That's drcherylselman.com, because if you opt in there, I get to send out the archives to you directly, as well as blogs and other information. And also like me over at my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know, because I post all my shows there. This is one of the shows I do, but I do another program on Progressive Radio Network every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, and that's called The Love Code, which has a spiritual focus and orientation, interviewing some wonderful spiritual teachers and authors and healers. So I hope you'll join me there as well. Okay, let's talk about my conversation today. We're really so fortunate to have with us as my guest, Dr. Dale Bredesen, who is the author of The End of Alzheimer's, a fantastic book, and I wanted to share a little bit about his background. Dr. Bredesen received his medical degree from Duke. He served as resident and chief resident of neurology at UCSF, then was postdoctoral fellow in the laboratory of Nobel laureate Professor Stanley Pusner. He was a faculty member at UCLA from 1989 to 1994, then was recruited by the Burnham Institute to direct the program of aging. In 1998, he became the founding president and CEO of the Buck Institute for Research on Aging, an adjunct professor at UCSF. Then in 2013, he returned to UCLA as the director of the Easton Center for Alzheimer's Disease Research. Bredesen Laboratory studies basic mechanisms underlying the neurodegenerative process and the translation of this knowledge into effective therapeutics for Alzheimer's disease and other neurodegenerative conditions, leading to the publication of over 220 research papers. He established the ADDN, which stands for Alzheimer's Drug Development Network, with Dr. Varghese John, leading to the identification of new classes of therapeutics for Alzheimer's disease. He and his group developed a new approach to the treatment of Alzheimer's disease, which led to the discovery of subtypes of Alzheimer's disease, followed by the first description of reversal of symptoms in patients with mild cognitive impairment and Alzheimer's disease, with the RECODE, which stands for Reversal of Cognitive Decline Protocol. In addition, Dr. Bredesen is a prodigious innovator in medicine with over 30 patents to his name. Notably, he put much of his finding and research into his 2017 New York Times best-selling book, The End of Alzheimer's, the first program to prevent and reverse cognitive decline. Wow. So it's just so fantastic to have him with us today. So hello, Dale. So nice to have you.
Hello, Cheryl. Thanks very much for having me.
Well, you have such an amazing background. I'm always awed by what doctors like you have accomplished in your life. It's just amazing that you have been able to do so much and to create such leading edge research that really is being able to help so many people, especially with a condition like Alzheimer's. So I'm very grateful for all the time and energy that you've invested in your career so you could be with us today.
Thank you for your kind words, Cheryl. We set out 30 years ago just to understand the details of the degenerative process because, as you know, this has been the area of greatest biomedical therapeutic failure. There hasn't been anything for Alzheimer's disease. There hasn't been anything for ALS. There hasn't been anything for Lewy body disease, frontotemporal dementia. You just go right down the line. This has been where medicine has failed therapeutically. And so we wanted to understand why that is. What's actually driving this?
So before we look at that in more depth, what are the latest statistics on conditions like Alzheimer's, which, of course, everyone is so concerned about, and some of the other conditions you mentioned, like ALS? Where are we with this disease and these conditions?
Yes, unfortunately, the news is not good when it comes to the statistics, as you know, because, as they say, everyone knows a cancer survivor, no one knows an Alzheimer's survivor. This has been something that's been difficult to do anything about, and we are looking at 5.5 million Americans currently with a diagnosis. Of the currently living Americans, because obviously many people are too young to know that they're going to get it, of the currently living Americans, about 323 million Americans, about 45 million will develop Alzheimer's disease, unfortunately. And we have about 75 million Americans who are at high risk with a specific gene called APOE4. Now, if you don't have that, it doesn't mean that you have zero risk. And if you do have it, it doesn't mean it's 100% risk. But it does give you, it's just like having high cholesterol for heart disease. It increases your risk. And so this is very important to address. So this is a major, major problem. And unfortunately, it is one that is on the rise. A recent paper from an excellent epidemiology group, Professor Christine Yaffe and her group, showed that this has now become the third leading cause of death in the United States after cardiovascular disease and cancer. And it's the one, as you know, as we talked about, that's actually been the most difficult to treat successfully. So these statistics, unfortunately, are somewhat grim.
And I also saw a statistic that said about two-thirds of Americans with Alzheimer's disease are women. I didn't know that.
That is correct. So this is a woman-centric disease. And by the way, Parkinson's is the opposite. More men with Parkinson's, more men with ALS. But this is a woman-centric disease, no question about it, about 2-to-1, as you indicated. Not only that, but the caregivers, about 60% are women. So this really is a disease that unfortunately strikes women in a very unfair way. They get struck with this more often than men.
Well, so as we get into this discussion, are we able to also, do you know why women are more vulnerable than men?
Nobody knows the reason why that is the case. There are some suggested possibilities. For example, as we get into how this actually works, you'll see that some of the things that are critically supportive of your brain's infrastructure, of your ability to make and keep these connections, so-called synapses. One of the most important things is your hormonal support. Numerous hormones, estradiol, progesterone, testosterone, pregnenolone, DHEA, all of these things are critical. Thyroid hormone, for example. And then, of course, a related molecule, vitamin D, that we call a vitamin, but it's really related to the hormones. All of these things are critical for keeping the structure of your brain. And as you know, when women go through menopause, there are rapid reductions, whereas when men go through andropause, the reduction is typically slower over more years. And that may be an important factor.
It may be, but, Alzheimer's is a relatively recent, I would call it, epidemic. Isn't it? I mean, it hasn't been the case like this for most of our known history. It's a relatively recent development of this condition to the degree that it's affecting so many people.
That's a very good point. It is clearly on the rise, as I mentioned earlier. And you're right, we did not see as much of this before, and we see even in specific groups. For example, when I was training, which was back in the 80s, we did not see people in their 50s getting Alzheimer's. We typically saw people 60s, 70s, 80s were the typical. Now, and especially women, we see people in their 50s and even early 50s and even late 40s developing Alzheimer's all the time. It's one of the more common presentations that we see now. So you can think of this to some extent. Unfortunately, Alzheimer's is at least in part the revenge of our abuse of our environment and ourselves.
Yeah, it's so scary that because as we get into this topic, it'll be evident there's so many drivers, and when they're combined together, the brain is so vulnerable for so many reasons. So why don't we start by defining what Alzheimer's is and what it isn't? Because I think there's a lot of confusion about what actually Alzheimer's, you know, is, how it shows up in the brain.
That is a great point. And the definition of Alzheimer's really has to do with pathology. So these are unfortunately things that were pathologically defined. If you look at a brain and it has what they call senile plaques or amyloid plaques, they're same things, and tangles, these are things that were described back in 1906 by Professor Alzheimer. And they are things that distinguish this. Now, if you look at people who become demented, so that is a global loss of cognition, often starts with loss of memory, but not always. Sometimes it's problems with organizing or problems with calculating or problems with visual recognition or problems with word finding or problems with spatial memory. All those things can be. So then you start and you go down a path that, as you know, is progressive, and you end up with something where you have a global cognitive loss. So as you know, ultimately the inability to dress yourself, to have your activities of daily living, et cetera. That is dementia. The majority of cases of dementia are caused by Alzheimer's. So Alzheimer's is the most important cause, the most common cause for dementia. There are many other causes, frontotemporal dementia, vascular dementia, things like that. But the most common one is Alzheimer's. So it is by definition pathologically defined. And therefore, when we develop this, we want to understand why. And one of the big problems had been that when you go into your doctor says, oh, you have Alzheimer's. Well, why do I have it? Well, we don't know. You just get it. It's like something that comes out of nowhere. And Alzheimer's itself doesn't tell you a lot, as you can tell. It's just a name. So it's as if you took your car in and things weren't working well with your car, and imagine that the mechanic said to you, oh, we know what that is. That's called car not working syndrome. And you said, well, wait a minute. I mean, aren't you going to check some tests and see why my car's not working? And the mechanic said, well, no, we don't do those because they're not reimbursed. That's unfortunately what's happened with Alzheimer's. People say, well, we don't know what causes it. We're not going to do much of evaluation. We're simply going to tell you you have Alzheimer's disease. There are some medications that have an absolutely minimal effect. They don't affect the decline itself. They may give you a temporary bump in your cognition, but they don't change the degenerative course. So that is a problem, and this is one of our major interests. What are the things that cause Alzheimer's? People talk about a cause, but what we found in the lab over 30 years is that it's not a single cause. This is a pathway, and there are many different things that contribute to it.
So we're going to talk about that. But before we do that, first of all, let's talk about different conditions. There's Alzheimer's, there's mild cognitive decline, then there's brain injury that can be affecting people. How do we make distinctions? You know, if people are starting to lose the words and, you know, just forgetful, I mean, sometimes that's the result of adrenal exhaustion, and that can affect short-term memory. So how do we know what's really going on so we can, first of all, not be panicked, and secondly, be able to chart a course of action?
Yeah, that's a very good point. So there are two things to remember about this. Number one is, as you're developing Alzheimer's, you go through essentially four phases. And that is, number one, you are asymptomatic, where the pathophysiology has already started in your brain. So you don't know it. In fact, you often have the underlying changes are going on for about 20 years before you have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's. At some period of time, you begin to notice a change, and this is then called SCI, subjective cognitive impairment. And that often lasts for 10 years. So you go through a period where you know something's not quite right. Others know something's not quite right sometimes, But if you actually go in and have testing at that time, you're still able to test within the normal range. And often the tests aren't sensitive enough to pick up these changes. So this is why we always tell people, when you start to notice a difference, please don't wait. It's the waiting that gets you in trouble. So after SCI, if you don't do anything about that, you then progress to MCI, which is mild cognitive impairment. And about 5 to 10% of people each year who have MCI will now progress to Alzheimer's disease. And by definition, when you have MCI, your testing is now showing that there's something abnormal, but you are still able to do the activities of daily living, things like dressing yourself and showering and things like that. When you convert from MCI over to Alzheimer's disease is when you start to lose your activities of daily living. And that can happen in 1 year, 2 years after MCI, 3 years. As I say, about 5 to 10% will convert each year. So those are the four stages, pre-symptomatic, SCI, MCI, Alzheimer's disease. And some people will progress rapidly and some people more slowly. But often what happens is, over time, the progression will become accelerated. So again, this is why we want to get in as early as possible. And as you said, there can be other contributors, things like head injury, things like inflammation, and numerous other things that can contribute to this. And there are, as I mentioned earlier, non-Alzheimer's related cognitive decline. Lewy body disease, for example, which is what Robin Williams suffered from, unfortunately, is very common. There are about 1 million Americans. It's one of the most common after Alzheimer's. So that's important to know. That one has its own pathophysiology and its own therapy.
Well, so all these questions are going through my mind. So can we define what happens in the brain? Because Alzheimer's has been treated because of plaque and these tau tangles, but that actually is not what's really going on in the brain. They're a symptom. They're really not the cause of Alzheimer's. So can we just go into that, and can you elaborate a little bit more about that?
Yes. So this is actually part of the global revolution in medicine. This has been unfortunate. What I learned was 20th century medicine, and 20th century medicine was about what it is. We were taught to learn to figure out, you know, is this measles? Is this a broken leg? Is this Alzheimer's? What is it? So it's what it is. And once you put a label on it, you write a prescription for it. It's Alzheimer's, you write a prescription for Aricept. But that, unfortunately, does not get at the root cause of what's actually driving the process. So this is what our research was all about, to understand, where does this come from? Why is it so common? And what's actually driving this process of Alzheimer's disease? And when you look at that, what you find is that there are dozens of things that can contribute to this. There is a biochemistry that is altered when you have this disease. And so we need to identify these things, things like ongoing inflammation, which can be from various infections, things like insulin resistance and glycotoxicity from sugar, literally, or prediabetes, things like reductions in nutrients, reductions in hormones, reductions in growth factors, and then very specific toxins. These can be inorganic toxins like metals, organic toxins like formaldehyde or toluene or benzene, or they can be biotoxins like toxins from molds. As you mentioned earlier, vascular disease, another one, and trauma, as you mentioned. So all of these things are critical players. And so when we identify someone who has cognitive changes, we now want to look more deeply and ask, what are the things that drove the decline in this person? So 21st century medicine is not about what it is, it's about why it is. You need to look more deeply to understand what drives the process. And just as there have been unprecedented successes in oncology with targeting cancer with so-called precision medicine, we're having unprecedented success with targeting the things that are driving the neurodegenerative process.
So it really becomes an integrative approach to healing the brain, but really the brain is symptomatic of all these other issues that have been affecting the body's ability to have optimal health, optimal functioning.
That's a really good point. It is an integrative approach, and again, an approach which wasn't taught in medical school, and I think hopefully will be taught more and more in medical school. But again, it goes against the grain of what we were all taught in medical school, and so we need to make this fundamental change in the way we think about these illnesses. What happened was, in the 20th century, the success that we had as physicians were due to basically the two things: public health measures that decreased various infections, and then, of course, antibiotics that worked wonderfully well. And so we used that strategy of a single drug, a monotherapy, for all diseases. And unfortunately, that's like using your checkers strategy for a chess match. We've now got more complicated diseases like Alzheimer's that are not due to a single agent. It's not like pneumococcal pneumonia. When you get pneumococcal pneumonia, yeah, there are many contributors, like if there's any alcohol on board, if you have diabetes, if you have B-cell dysfunction, for example, you have multiple myeloma. But by far and away, the most important thing, of course, is the pneumococcus itself. So if you just kill that, everything's okay. You could forget about the other stuff. That's not the way it is with Alzheimer's and other complex chronic illnesses. You have dozens of things that all contribute, and there's no one single thing like the pneumococcus is in pneumonia where you can just go after that one thing and fix everything. So it's literally a fundamentally different way to think about disease, to think about medicine, and to think about treatment. And you have to do that. You have to identify and address these various contributors to get people to actually reverse their cognitive decline. And we described the first ones back in 2014. Again, in 2016, we just put out a paper in 2018 describing 100 patients with documented Alzheimer's and pre-Alzheimer's who had documented improvement in their cognition with this sort of multi-pronged approach.
Well, good, because we're going to talk about that, and I think that's what really people want to know. But it just seemed, you know, as you're bringing this integrative approach in, it still seems that the medical community is relying on pharmaceutical drugs and maybe some, you know, testing, like I said, MRIs, PET scans. But, that seems like a huge challenge right there to bring people into the profession to understand this more integrative approach, which is not how most doctors have been trained.
Absolutely. And as the leader of one medical school told me, we would like to teach this new approach, but we can't do that until all doctors accept it. And, of course, all doctors won't accept it until we teach it. So this is a real problem. We are, you know, here we are right near Silicon Valley, you know, the world home of disruption and change, paradigm shifts. But with medicine, it's really about tradition and permission. It's not about paradigm shifts. And of course, understandably, we don't want to make people worse, as they say in medicine, primum non nocere, first do no harm. But ultimately, we are not helping these people who have complex chronic illnesses, and millions of people literally are dying. There are about 30 million people globally with dementia. So this is a huge problem, and we want to decrease this dramatically. And with what we now know, we can decrease. This should be the final generation for Alzheimer's as a common illness. We can make Alzheimer's a rare disease and should make Alzheimer's a rare disease. I'm actually on my way to Japan in just 2 weeks to do exactly that. They're looking at a nationwide program to reduce cognitive decline using this multifunctional approach. And I hope that we will be doing this all over the world at some point, because the reality is Alzheimer's should be a rare disease, just as it once was.
Well, that's very exciting for you to see your research expanding out throughout the world. And it really requires people to understand that we have to make changes. Like anything, you can't heal in the environment that got you sick. So you need to start looking at all those factors, which I think we'll just jump into right now, Dale. Let's go through the list of what you have found and incorporated in your protocol that has been really successful with those 100 or so patients you've been working with?
Yes, and so we currently look at 150 different variables, which again, from a computer standpoint, we use a computer-based algorithm, is a tiny number. You know, we should be looking at millions, and ultimately that's what will be happening. You know, our doctors should be doing more with integrating with computer-based algorithms so that we can look at these complex illnesses. But the simple way to think about this, if you look at it, the drivers of this process fall into a couple of different groups. So what we call type 1 Alzheimer's, this is predominantly driven by inflammation. And so many of us, you know, they even call it inflammaging. So many of us have inflammation, and it does contribute to our aging, and it does contribute to our Alzheimer's. And, of course, it does contribute to our cardiovascular disease and, of course, to some cancers as well. Rheumatoid arthritis, go right down the list. The chronic illnesses of aging often, not always, but often have an inflammatory component. And we typically get that because we have a leaky gut, or because we have a bad diet and we develop metabolic syndrome, or because, you know, we're eating things that are inflammatory, or because we have periodontitis or gingivitis. All of these things can contribute. Or we have had a tick bite and we've developed Lyme disease that we're unaware of. One of the women we dealt with turned out to have babesia, which is a relative of malaria, from a tick bite she had 10 years before. And that fixing that helped her cognitive decline. She's turned around and done very, very well. So all of these things can contribute. And, of course, other organisms from your mouth or herpes simplex from your lip, cold sores, things like this, these are all ways to have systemic inflammation and brain inflammation. And so we want to look at that and we want to address that. Now, people often say, oh, just take an anti-inflammatory. It's not quite that simple. Yes, we want to quell the inflammation, but we also want to, if there's an organism involved, we want to get rid of that organism. If it's leaky gut that is doing this, we want to heal the gut and then optimize the microbiome, as you well know. If we have significant periodontitis, and by the way, if you look in the brains of patients with Alzheimer's, what do you find? You find P. gingivalis from the oral microbiome. You find herpes simplex from your lip. You find various fungi and molds from your sinuses. So you find the very things that are affecting you peripherally, which actually over time make their way into your brain. And so what we call Alzheimer's disease has turned out to be, surprise, a protective response of your brain to these various insults, starting with these various pathogens. So interestingly, you can almost think of Alzheimer's as a success story. You are holding these things at bay. Your brain would have had trouble 20 years earlier. But for 20 years, you're keeping these things at bay by spritzing this amyloid that we associate with Alzheimer's on these things. And you earlier mentioned the amyloid and the tau. These are a protective response to the various insults. And this is why people have gotten confused. Oh, we want to get rid of that bad amyloid. Well, yes, the amyloid is downsizing your brain. It's doing it to protect you. So before you get rid of the amyloid, please get rid of the things that are causing the amyloid. So that's what we call type 1 or inflammatory or hot Alzheimer's. Type 2 is atrophic. So if you simply take away all the support from your brain, then no surprise, your brain isn't able to juggle all these things and dealing. You know, it's a dynamic process. You're dealing with pathogens each day. You're dealing with, you know, every time you brush your teeth, you're dealing with all these things and you're dealing with them very effectively. But no surprise, if you get rid of all the support, and you can go right down the list, as we talked about, estradiol, progesterone, pregnenolone, free T3, T4, you know, DHEA, nerve growth factor, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, vitamin D, all of these things are part of your support. And again, it's just like taking your company. You can either have trouble with your overall infrastructure and your overall function of your company because people are raiding you and stealing from you every day. That's like the pathogens, type 1, or because you have no finances coming in. You simply can't support that company. In this case, you're supporting your brain. And so this is the same story, which is why you need to optimize these things. So that's what we call type 2 or atrophic Alzheimer's. And then there's a type 1.5, which has both. It has some inflammation and it has an atrophic effect, and that is when you have too much sugar. Literally, you have insulin resistance, and therefore your neurons don't respond to insulin the way they once did. And so therefore insulin, which actually is quite supportive for your neurons. We used to grow neurons in the lab all the time. You always have to put insulin in the dish to grow the neurons because they use that as a growth factor. Or you additionally have the glucose. And what happens? You get proteins glycated. So what literally happens is the glucose, when it's too high in your blood, it attaches itself to proteins just like remoras on a shark. And it literally sticks to them. Now, we measure it, of course, as hemoglobin A1C. That's hemoglobin with a sugar stuck onto it. But as you can imagine, it sticks onto lots of other proteins. So hemoglobin A1C is just an indicator. It's actually sticking to hundreds of proteins. And when it does that, it alters their structure and it alters their function. And so therefore, they don't work quite as well. And your immune system actually recognizes the change in shape. And you now have an inflammatory response. So you get the worst of both worlds. You get both the inflammation and you get the trophic loss. So that's what we call type 1.5. The good news of that, which is sweet Alzheimer's, the good news with that is it's the most fixable. That's something that can be fixed with diet, exercise, sleep, stress, a few other things. You can do very, very well. And then type 3 is toxic Alzheimer's. And as I mentioned earlier, metals like mercury, organics like benzene, toluene, formaldehyde, and then biotoxins like mycotoxins. There are dozens and dozens of these mold-related toxins. And it really has been a hidden epidemic. We estimate that there are at least 500,000 Americans who have this type of type 3 Alzheimer's due to these toxins that have really been unrecognized. You can pick these up, trichothecenes that come from Stachybotrys, the toxic black mold, and things like ochratoxin A, gliotoxin, zearalenone, mycophenolic acid, on and on and on. These things are literally fighting for their own lives. So they are putting out these toxins to fight bacteria, to fight things that are competing with the molds for survival. And unfortunately, they are damaging. They're damaging to our nervous systems. They're damaging to our immune systems. And that's one of the biggest problems. When you knock down someone's immune system, what do you think happens to all these pathogens? They get into your brain. What do? You make Alzheimer's disease, trying to defend yourself from these pathogens. So it's a real problem when you are chronically exposed to these mycotoxins that are reducing your immune system's ability to fight the various pathogens that we're exposed to every day. So the molds are literally making a home for themselves by making it so that you can't fight them off. And then they can live in your sinuses, they can live in your gut, they can live in your brain, so forth and so on. So that's something that's critical to look at, these various toxins. And then that's type 3. Type 4, as I mentioned, is vascular. Type 5 is traumatic. So yes, people who've had head trauma are at increased risk for Alzheimer's disease. And of course, also for CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. So these are the different groups, and we therefore want to target the treatment to what is going on. And if you want, we can talk about the different treatment for each one. Most people have more than one subtype that contributes to their decline, but they often have a dominant subtype.
Well, absolutely, we need to do that. You know, it's just so fascinating because for all these things to get into the brain, you have to break down your blood-brain barrier, which was supposed to protect us, but for many reasons, which I'm sure you'll help us understand, it's not really being effective at all anymore. It's allowing all these toxins and molds and inflammation just to enter into the brain. So our protection from all of these factors is no longer available to us. We've breached the wall, so
right.
to speak.
Well, and so that's a good point. And the blood-brain barrier is still very important and it's still very effective. But the problem is that there are many doors through it. That's the problem. And so, yes, we used to think of this as, yeah, this is just excluding all these things except the stuff we want in our brains. But it turns out that there are multiple ways to get through it. So as you indicated, there it can be leaky. And, in fact, it is found to be leaky in Alzheimer's disease relatively early in the process. So as soon as you're developing that cognitive decline, it's already not perfect. It's already leaking a little bit. Second thing, there are organisms that literally have ways through it. So an interesting experiment was done about a year ago where mice were injected. They, of course, have a blood-brain barrier that's similar. They were injected with the simple yeast Candida. And people thought, oh, well, Candida is not going to get through the blood-brain barrier, but let's see where it goes. Guess what? It went right through a normal blood-brain barrier. Candida went right through it, set up shop in the brain, and what was the response? Very much like the earliest changes of Alzheimer's disease. So organisms have ways to get through our blood-brain barrier, unfortunately. And then, of course, as you indicated, there are various toxins, and they can sometimes leak through. They also sometimes have transport mechanisms that where we're taking them up thinking it's something else, and they can get into the brain that way. So there are, unfortunately, these multiple doors into our brains, and these various organisms and toxins, unfortunately, use them to get into our brains. So, in fact, you do have a dynamic, ongoing fight and struggle with these various things. And when you're young, you're doing well with the struggle. You're keeping it up for the most part. But as we get a little older, we may not be doing as well. So what we want to do, obviously, keep that thing just as we want the gut barrier to be nice and closed, get the right microbiome. We want the blood-brain barrier to be nice and closed, keeping these organisms out of our brains to the extent that we can. And again, since it's a dynamic process, when you're going the right direction, you're now flushing these things out. You're fighting them off. You're getting rid of them, and you're literally flushing them out ultimately. So when you're doing poorly, of course, you're on the wrong side of that seesaw. You're now collecting them. No different, by the way, than what you would see with cardiovascular disease, where if you're doing the right things, you're actually taking away the plaque. You're actually doing better and better, just as Dr. Dean Ornish showed 35 years ago. You're now reducing the plaque. But when you're doing the wrong things, you're accumulating the plaque until, unfortunately, you have an occlusion.
So we're going to go through all those types, but I just want to make one comment. You know, you are such a leader in this field of unraveling this mystery and making these classifications. But I'm wondering, for people who are concerned about their cognitive functioning, how many doctors know about these categories and can begin to address and evaluate the drivers for these different conditions?
That's a great question. So we've now trained 1,500 doctors from 10 different countries and all over the United States. So there are doctors out there, but you're right. The vast majority of doctors are unaware of this, despite the fact we've published this repeatedly in peer-reviewed journals, et cetera. But people, you know, we tend to practice the way we were trained in medical school. So it does take a while for things to change. You're absolutely right about that.
Yeah. Okay. So let's go through the best strategies that you've come across that you recommend to deal with all these different types, the interventions that seem to work the best, and what we need to know. So right now we can start making changes and understand the absolute need, how imperative it is to start making these changes.
Right. So again, what we're doing now is we're influencing your brain's biochemistry. If you have begun cognitive decline, then it's already telling you are on the wrong side of that balance. If you literally look at what's at the heart of Alzheimer's disease, the quintessence of Alzheimer's is a protein called APP, amyloid precursor protein. It's the thing that gives rise to the amyloid that we associate with Alzheimer's disease. And if things are good, then you are able to make and keep synapses, and the APP is then cut at one site, and it makes two fragments that literally say, things are good, let's grow. We can make synapses, just like your company, saying things are good, we can hire new people, we can grow. On the other hand, when things are bad, you've got pathogens at the gates, you've got toxins that have infiltrated your brain, you don't have enough support, hormonal, nutrients, trophic factor, et cetera, then it says, oh, we've got to downsize, we've got to protect ourselves, and we're going to have to operate, again, just like your company saying, to survive, we're going to have to downsize our company. Very much the same sort of thing. In that case, the APP is cut at three sites, so you now have four pieces, and they are literally like memos going out and saying, okay, things are not good, we're going to go into protect mode, and we're going to downsize. So what we want to know, since someone who's got cognitive decline, we know, is on the wrong side of that, then we want to know why. And you can kind of think of it in two ways, prevention and reversal. So if we look at the reversal, obviously, a little more complicated, a little harder. We want to know what's causing it. If you have inflammagens, if you have pathogens, something causing inflammation, then typically what we want to do is we want to resolve the inflammation. And there are things called resolvents that you can use. They actually come from omega-3 fats. So high doses of omega-3s are helpful. But while you're doing that, of course, you want to find out what's causing this. If you have a leaky gut, you want to heal up your gut. And there are numerous ways to do this. People use, as you know, use bone broth. People use various short chain, like probutyrate, for example, these sorts of molecules that are made by your agents of your microbiome that help you to make your gut healed up. So many of us have a leaky gut and don't even know it. And, of course, this can lead to all sorts of inflammatory conditions. So we want to do that.
Okay, so let's go to type 2.
Right, so type 2 is atrophic, and in that case, we want to increase. We want to make sure you have an optimal vitamin D, optimal hormones. All these are critical. And when I say optimal, that's another important point. We are often told something is within normal limits, which is completely arbitrary. It simply means it's within two standard deviations of the mean. And, of course, vitamin B12 is a simple example. You can have a normal B12, low normal, and have major problems, pernicious anemia, brain damage, nervous system, you know, spinal cord damage with a, quote, normal B12. So we want things to be optimal, not simply normal. And so then you can actually increase trophic factors. There's an interesting new thing on the market called whole coffee fruit extract, which actually increases your brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Of course, exercise is another great way to increase your BDNF. Guess what? Ketosis also increases your BDNF. So through all these ways, we want to optimize your hormones, nutrients, and trophic factors for type 2. Then, I mentioned earlier, if you have pathogens, we want to get rid of those pathogens as well. You want to support your immune system. Again, as you are doing poorly with your nutrients, with your hormones, et cetera, your immune system has difficulties, especially if you have mycotoxins, which are often immunotoxic. So we need to support the immune system. And there are things like what's called AHCC that support the immune system. And again, just good living and good nutrition actually helps to support your immune system, as do, you know, other things. Tinospora has been used for thousands of years from Ayurvedic medicine, actually turns out to be helpful for your immune system. So all of these things can be helpful. And then for type 3, type 3 is the toughest one to treat because these toxins get into your body and unfortunately are in multiple organs. They can be there for years. So it does take some time to detox. But there are some simple basic things that we can all do and we should all be doing just for general detox, just to minimize our exposure. Things like having a high fiber diet, as you know, just the fiber. I've been shocked by how important fiber is. It helps your cholesterol. It helps your insulin resistance. It helps your detoxification. It helps your microbiome. It, you know, helps you to prevent things like IBS. It's on and on and on. Very important. So whether you like to do this through specific plants you like to eat, probably the best way, or if you like to supplement it with things like organic psyllium husk or PGX, konjac root, things like that. Whatever it is important. And we should be having high fiber. We probably, our forebears probably had something like 100 grams a day of fiber, if you look at the various tubers they were eating and things like that. Many of us have fewer than 10 grams per day. So, you know, we want to get ourselves up more like 30 grams or more per day through the foods we're eating, et cetera. And then, of course, we talked about microbiome before, things like probiotics and prebiotics. Once your gut is healed, helpful to take probiotics. And again, you can do this with fermented foods, and then you can do it with prebiotic foods as well, things like jicama and Jerusalem artichoke and things like that. So all of these things are helpful together. And you want to detox. I mentioned general detox, things like filtered water, making sure that you have enough filtered water each day. Doing it's things that make you sweat, whether you like to ride a bicycle, whether you like to get into a sauna. And then, you know, after that, using some non-emollient soap. These things all help to reduce your toxic load. And often we don't know that we have a toxic load until we get an illness like Alzheimer's disease. So we want to minimize that toxic load. One of the interesting things that's come out of all of this work and the patients, we now have thousands of patients that are on this. By the way, we just got the first 200 follow-up MoCA scores from the people who are on the program. And these first 200, 90% of them showed improvements in their MoCA scores. 10% of them showed decline. So we're very excited to see. This is something where in the past, 0%, of course, with current therapy, that you just don't have a way to improve this. So we're very excited to see this. And at the same time, we want to know, what about those other 10%? Why are they not showing improvement? What can we do to enhance that? Two of the most common things that have come out to be important have been desaturation of oxygen at night. So people who have either sleep apnea or who may not have sleep apnea but still may desaturate their oxygen at night. There are a number of reasons you can do that. So I recommend to everybody, get your oximetry checked at night. And then the other thing that's come up to be very common is periodontitis. As I mentioned, you find the organisms from your mouth in the brains of patients with Alzheimer's disease. So very good idea to check to see, and there's actually a nice test now, oral DNA is the test, and it will tell you, do you have the pathogens that are typically found in the brains of Alzheimer's patients in your mouth, or are you doing well enough with your oral hygiene? And if not, you might consider things like using dental side and toothpaste, which is a biocide and literally kills these pathogens. And there are now on the market some oral microbiome support, so literally probiotics for your mouth and sinuses that you can get. These things are helpful. They are literally helping you to fight the pathogens. So that's another important thing to check. Enhancing your support for vasculature, there's something called EWOT. And you may have talked about this with your group before. Exercise with oxygen training. You literally get on a bicycle, typically for only 15, 20 minutes a day, but you do it in the presence of a mask with oxygen. If you've got a vascular component to your cognitive decline, it's a good thing to, at least to give yourself a trial for a month or so. See if that actually helps you, because it certainly supports the delivery of support for your neurons in your brain. And then for people, as I mentioned, for vascular, some people like to use nitric oxide sources as well, because you're dilating the vessels. And the beetroot juice is a way to go there. There's a thing called Neo40, another way to go. And then I mentioned the EWOT, all of those things. You increase your nitric oxide, of course, with just good exercise as well. So all of these are, again, we're now getting at what's causing the cognitive decline instead of treating blindly. I should mention, every single clinical trial in the past, and there have been over 400 of them, they virtually all failed. In one decade, 255 clinical trials, 254 failed. So every single one except one, which has a minimal effect. Mm-hmm. So every single trial in the past has been predetermined what the treatment was. So in other words, you're treating blindly. You're not asking what caused the problem. We are now in the midst of the very first trial in history where we're actually taking each person and asking, what is causing your cognitive decline, and treating that set of things. We're treating the root cause of the illness as a first. And by the way, we tried to do this back in 2011. It was turned down because, of course, it's multifactorial. And the IRBs would like you to do one thing at a time. But, of course, that's not the way the disease works. We were turned down again in 2018, again, because it was multivariable. We finally got the okay to go ahead in 2019. And so we're now in the midst of this trial. And this is being done with Dr. Anne Hathaway, who's well-versed on this protocol, Dr. Kathleen Toops, also well-versed, and Dr. Deborah Gordon, also well-versed. And so they're excellent physicians and excellent with integrative and functional medicine, and they are dealing with people who have cognitive decline using a targeted precision approach that actually addresses the root cause of the decline.
Yeah, well, this is also exciting, really, because you have to heal at the root cause level. You know, as a naturopathic doctor, I guess I have an advantage over a lot of, you know, traditionally trained medical doctors, because root cause is always where you go, right? You always,
yep.
There's a reason
yep.
why you have this condition, and that's where you look, and you start eliminating and peeling back all the factors. A couple of things I wanted to ask you. I've done a lot of investigation, lecturing, and writing about the role of electromagnetic radiation and the Wi-Fi world, which seems to be a major player and probably unrecognized because of its effect on creating inflammation in the body and breaking down the blood-brain barrier and the consequences. Do you have any thoughts about that?
You know, it's a very good point, and we've been talking about this for a few years now. EMF's likely to be a contributor. But here's the problem. We need a good test. You know, right now, if we say, well, does this person have mycotoxins, we have tests to look at those. We can say, okay, we can also look at the immunological response to them. We also know the symptoms. So we really have a good set of things we can do to say yes or no for these mycotoxins or for other things. We don't have that yet for EMFs, which is really unfortunate. So we can measure the EMFs that are around us, but we don't know if they are harming our brain or not. So I would love from anyone who has a test to be able to say whether a person is actually being affected by EMFs, I'd love to see it. Is there something we can measure in blood? Is there something we can measure in other bodily fluids? Love to know, because that's been the big problem. And I think when we're able to do that, we'll have a much better look at what people this is actually affecting more versus what people it's affecting less. And I agree with you. It's likely to be a contributor. We think in terms of chemotoxins and biotoxins, where these are essentially physical toxins. So, you know, these are things that we need to understand their effects and how to treat them and prevent them. We can start simply by doing things like turning off the Wi-Fi at night and things like that and staying away from EMFs. But until we have a better method to measure them, it's going to be tough to do things optimally.
Right. And that's unfortunate, right? Because as we move into the 5G world, we're just exacerbating conditions that could be, I don't want to belabor it, but I just have to say that EMFs exacerbate parasites, they exacerbate dysbiosis, they exacerbate heavy metals, according to the work of Dietrich Klinkhardt. So it's like a lot of these factors are exacerbated from being exposed to EMFs. The other thing I want to ask you real quick, because we're coming to the end, light, the role of light. And that's an area that I've really been fascinated by, you know, how we do not have enough sunlight and we're too much with blue light and artificial light and how it's affecting our brain from being indoors and being on screens all the time. You have any thoughts about that?
Absolutely. And by the way, there are multiple roles here. One of the things that has been noticed is as people get on the right protocol, as they're improving their neurochemistry, it is actually helpful to have stimulation. Now, we think of stimulation in terms of brain training and things like that. Great. Those are very helpful, and they are part of the protocol. diet, exercise, sleep, stress, brain training, all part of that, herbs, supplements. These are all key. Targeting the pathogens, all these are key. But the other thing that's helpful is actually to have some stimulation for your brain in terms of either magnetic or light. So you probably know Violite, which is many people use that successfully. And I think it's been helpful for a number of these people who seem to do better with that. Now, having said that, you're right. The specific lights that we're exposed to are critical. They're critical to help you set your circadians, of course. So, yes, when you get up in the morning, you want to get that exposure. And, of course, when you travel, that's an issue. You need to reset. You may want to use some melatonin. And then, as one of my friends who was a researcher in circadian rhythms and the parts of the brain that are important for circadian rhythms said, you know, if you are traveling to the West where things are setting later, you want to go out at the end of the day and essentially show your brain, yes, the sun is still up. If you're traveling east where things are coming up earlier, you want to get out there earlier in the day to show your brain, yes, the sun is already up now. And then you're right. You don't want to then confuse your brain at night by turning on lights that have blue light and are telling your brain, oh, it's still daytime. And we see this as a major problem in people, of course, with macular degeneration. And now we're dealing with the first few people with a similar sort of approach that we use with Alzheimer's. But, of course, it is modified for the particular biochemistry of macular degeneration. And the same idea we would do for, you know, Lewy body, ALS, all these things have their own biochemistries. They all represent mismatches between the supply and the demand of their particular subsystem. So as you indicated, there's a big issue now as we have changed over to more LED lighting. Unfortunately, that has in general a worse overall spectrum for saving your eyesight. And so you're right. As night comes, you want to minimize the light. A lot of people like blue blockers. Get those on. You don't want to have a lot of exposure to blue light because it will make it more difficult. It will inhibit your melatonin. It will affect your sleep. So absolutely, light critical for numerous reasons.
Well, you know, you're such a revolutionary. I just really applaud you, Dale. I'm sure it hasn't been easy at times to buck the system. I don't know why. Maybe that's why you called your institute the Buck Institute. But, no, you know.
Nothing to do with bucking the system.
But, you know, you are. You're bucking the system. You're a radical in your own way. And we're also grateful to you because the approach that you've been committed to, that you've been, you know, invested your life with, which is now getting recognition around the world, is really truly trailblazing solutions for a condition that the traditional medical world can do nothing for. And not only that, but all the factors that have been ignored, which are driving this, are now have a chance to be recognized as part of a pattern rather than just be oblivious and never really getting any change, just seeing things worsen. And like you said, with this knowledge, we can end the Alzheimer's epidemic that's going on. So it's really inspirational. So we've come to the end, but there's so much more information I'm sure you have in your book. So everyone needs to get a copy of The End of Alzheimer's by Dr. Dale Bredesen, the first program to prevent and reverse cognitive decline. You can go to his institute, buckinstitute.org. Will there be a list of practitioners you've trained if they go to buckinstitute.org?
No, if they go to drbredesen.com, there's a support group there that can help.
Okay, so that's Dr. Bredesen, B-R-E-D-E-S-E-N.
D-R-B-R-E-D-E-S-E-N. That's correct. Yeah.
Okay. So you can find out who may be in your neighborhood, in your country, that can help you if you are dealing with any of the symptoms that concern you. Dr. Dale Bredesen, thank you so, so much for everything you are doing and for your very precious time today. We are so grateful to you. It's just been such a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
To have you on the show. So,
thank you, Cheryl. Okay. What's Alzheimer's is a rare disease.
Yeah, I'm with you. And to all of my listeners, thank you for joining me. And remember to always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. And until next week, you take care. Have a good one. Bye for now.